So we're here with the Linguistic Data Consortium's Executive Director, Christopher Sieri. How are you doing today?
Good, John. Thanks for organizing this.
Oh, no problem. So you have a doctorate in linguistics and an extensive background in computer science. How did those interests develop, and which came first?
Okay, so it's a long story, but maybe worth telling. I think they developed roughly at the same time, actually. My parents come from sort of both sides of that. My dad is an electronics engineer with interests in things like astrophysics and also science fiction. And my mom's interests were in art and art history, language and writing, and anything Egypt. Growing up, they read a lot, and we have bookshelves that in my old house that lined the front wall of the house from floor to ceiling with books stacked too deep. And we were allowed to read any of those that we wanted, and we frequently did. In fact, I can remember two kind of movie tropes that come from each side of the interest. The scientist who has to discover some solution to some problem in the movie, and he's working at his lab desk through the night, and you find him sleeping on the desk the next day, but he's got the solution. I love movies that have that trope in it. And also the one guy in the group in an adventure movie who speaks the language that nobody else speaks. Those are tropes that from when I was a kid, I always loved movies that have those and show both, I think, the science and the language. So up through high school, my passions were sports, languages, and math and science. I eventually realized that I wasn't going to do well making a career out of sports. Just the chances of succeeding are just too low, I mean, on average for people who play sports. So I think I was beginning to develop a preference for the language side because all of my electives in school were languages and also kind of communications and writing things. At the same time, activities were frequently math and science related. So I gave up my lunches and worked after school in a program that one of the math teachers had developed where you could study things like linear algebra and basic programming on a Radio Shack TRS-80. So I was still doing some of those, but tending to do more linguistics. The epiphany came when I was in my sophomore year and I was taking speech communications, and one day the teacher came in. And instead of teaching the normal stuff, covered exactly how all the sounds of English were made in the mouth, what the tongue and lips were doing. So I was riveted, and I recognized that that was different from everything else he taught, and asked him about it after class. And he explained that there was this field called linguistics and what it was about. And he told me about the pen program that he had gone through. And so that was what I was going to do. I was settled by then. And luckily, Penn cooperated and admitted me. So I came to Penn. My big plan was to do my BA and MA in 4 years, which is the same thing he had done, because I thought probably 4 years was all I would spend on college, and get a minor in computer science and spend my electives, any electives that were left over, on languages and like anthropology and psychology and so forth. I mostly did that. However, about 3 or 4 classes into the computer science stuff, I realized that after the introductory material, I didn't really enjoy like the formal properties of computer grammars, the compiler theory, the system design, this kind of stuff that they were teaching. So I stopped taking the computer courses because I had realized by then that what I really liked about computers was what I could do with them, not studying them. And so I stopped taking the computer science courses, but kept using computers in other classes to make my life easier. Interestingly, about 3 semesters into linguistics, I had realized that I was doing better in my non-linguistics classes than in my linguistics classes, and I'd actually considered changing majors at that point. But I mentioned this to my French teacher at the time, who was Nadine O'Connor, who was finishing a PhD in the linguistics program while teaching French to pay her bills. And she said, "Before you make up your mind, try taking some classes with a professor named John Fott." So I did. I took a phonology and morphology classes of his, and I did well and really began to enjoy and also do well in my studies with him. He invited me to work for a new venture that he had called the Language Analysis Center, which was sort of like what LDC does today, only small bits of it, actually. And so I ended up working for the Language Analysis Center for 7 years. One more thing. So 7 years into its history, there was a funding constriction at the Language Analysis Center. So that John had to lay everyone off on staff, and only he was left. At that point, that was not a great time to be without a job, and this job had turned into full time by then. It had gone from work study to research assistant to full time job. it was not a great time to be without a job because my daughter was expected. So I looked around to find, you know, the first thing I could find that would pay the bills. And the only position I saw that I could do was a job in IT at the law school. So I took it because we needed to have money and we needed insurance. And I spent 8 years actually at the law school working there, you know, mostly to pay bills, but at the same time learned, I think, through the Language Analysis Center a lot about research computing, a lot about Unix and Unix utilities like SED and AUK, and I even learned how to program in C while I was there. And then at the law school, I learned a lot about IT and a lot about management. So that's it. The linguistics, my training has been principally in linguistics with a little bit of computer science, and then the rest of what I know about computing comes from like using it on the job. That's where my background comes from.
Excellent. Yeah. I seem to remember from Natalia's interview that there was the executive director before you was from Language Analysis Center too?
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Who is that and how did you transition into here?
So there's a funny story about that. Several years into working for the law school, although I really enjoyed the position there and the people there, I had gotten antsy because I really wanted to get back into what I was trained to do. In the meantime, I was taking some of Mark Lieberman's classes in phonetics, and I also knew him because he and I were both on some university-wide task forces where I was representing the law school and he was representing the faculty. And so at one day I worked up the nerve to ask him if I could have a job. And I had this whole elaborate speech planned out that I was going to give him. And, the day I chose to ask him this question, he was finishing up a class and I think rushing to his office. So I stopped him and I said, can I talk to you for a minute? Hoping he would invite me into the office and I could deliver this pitch, right? And he stopped right there in the middle of the classroom and said, sure, what is it? So I was embarrassed by the fact that there were students packing their bags all around me and didn't deliver the pitch. Instead, I just blurted something stupid out. And I don't remember what it was, but it wasn't what I had prepared, and it wasn't impressive. And Mark just looked at me and said, okay. And he turned and walked into his office. So I figured, okay, that's never going to happen, right? That didn't go well. And so we heard no more about it. And I got used to the idea that I was going to be at the law school for a long time. And in fact, started to look for some way to do sort of computer-rated analysis of legal text. That's just a way to keep doing something interesting while I was working at this job that paid the bills. So maybe 2 years pass, and out of the blue, I get an email message from Mark saying, remember that discussion we had 2 years ago? Still interested? So we met over lunch at the White Dog, and basically the situation was he had just lost his managing director, who was Michael Lenker, and he wanted to know if I wanted to take the job. So he told me I should come to LDC and do cold interviews with senior staff members at LDC, learn what it is they did, and then report back to him how I think LDC should be structured, and give him an org chart that had me reporting to him and everybody else reporting to me. And that was the nature of our job interview. So we did the official stuff. There was a posting and all that stuff. But I think the decision was more or less made over lunch. And that was my first lesson in how Mark works, which is, you know, he integrates information kind of on contact, and he makes very efficient, very effective decisions kind of effortlessly, and there's no ceremony about anything he does. So, you know, there was no, like, announcements, or it just started working. That's how he works. You asked about the about Michael Lenker. So after the funding constriction that I had mentioned, John Fott rebuilt the Language Analysis Center into something that was actually bigger and maybe more effective than even it was before the constriction. At some point, though, he left to go work for industry. He moved to the West Coast and started working for an MT company. And there were still some grants running. And so the university wanted to have somebody to administer the grants. So as I understand it, they asked Mark Lieberman to take over. But they didn't want the entire burden over these two organizations to be on him because he also had a full teaching load and a research agenda. So they appointed, or together they agreed to appoint, this fellow named Michael Lenker, who had been working, I think, with the LSA also, as managing director and for both organizations, for LAC and LDC. And so he took over and he stayed another 2 years maybe. And then at the point at which he left, we had these two organizations that had to be integrated. And that's when I took over.
So yeah, in 1998, when you arrived, what were the LDC's principal activities?
So the DARPA grant that had funded LDC, the five-year grant that had funded us to become the kind of distribution agency that we now are, was over, just over. LDC was distributing effectively and had several of the classic corporate were already in the catalog, so Timit and Switchboard. They also had by then developed the ability to collect and transcribe broadcast news and conversational telephone speech. LDC had just gotten the grant to do the provide data for the topic detection and tracking program from DARPA. Mm-hmm. And they had just installed the VOA satellite on the roof, that gigantic satellite that's now across the street, was just installed to be kind of the collection mechanism for LDC for the future. And that's what they were doing at the point at which I arrived.
So they had already started the collection sort of mechanism, mm-hmm. that was already in place. So once you got here, how did you drive that into the future?
Right. So when I came here, the most important goal that Mark gave me was to develop the annotation part of LDC. Until then, I think annotation had mostly been things like auditing for telephone call quality and also segmentation and transcription. I mean, for purposes of time alignment, segmentation and transcription. And that's really all they did. But Mark correctly guessed or knew that annotation was going to be a growth industry in our field. And so he asked me to try to work on growing that. So that was one task. I think another task was to rebuild the, or to further build the collection infrastructure, because at that point it was pretty, it required manual effort, a lot of manual effort at the time. We were hand loading VHS cassettes into recorders. That's how we got broadcast news back then. And, you know, we needed to move to something more automated. And maybe the third piece of work that we needed to do was to solve this problem about the organizational boundary between Language Analysis Center and LDC that existed. So the organizations had grown up together, had been merged, as I explained to you, but they were still really two different organizations in the same space. And what we needed to succeed was to have, I think, effectively one organization with all the qualifications and skill set that were in the two organizations, but having them be organized as one and operating together effectively. So that was a big challenge. Maybe one more goal that I imposed on myself very shortly after coming to LDC was to try to turn it into an organization that could be pretty independent of Mark's time. That is, in the first couple of weeks, I had seen just how much demand there was for his time. We didn't share an office, but I was two doors down from him. And it was just constant interruptions, constant phone ringing. He was frequently scheduled for meetings three deep, the same hour. He was supposed to be in three different places, mm-hmm. Which continues today, of course. And so I felt like in order for LDC to succeed, we'd have to set it up so that we were pretty independent. So my arrangement with Mark was, anything we know we can do without you, we're going to do without you. Anything we think we might be able to do without you, but we think it's going to be a challenge and we might maybe could fail, we'll also do without you. The only thing we're going to consult you for is the thing where we know we're going to fail if we don't have your help. So we were really biasing in terms of independence. And that required some challenges for both of us. First of all, he had to accept, you know, sort of handing over control to somebody who was new. And he had to be ready to sort of clean up if I screwed up in a big way. And I had to also be ready for the embarrassment of screwing up, maybe publicly, which is, you know, never fun, right?
Right.
But we felt like that was, I felt like that was the only way the place could really succeed, because we could not rely on getting his time multiple times per day, just given the other demands that were placed on him by the university. And so we put it in place, and happily the number of major failures that we've had is much rarer than I would have predicted. It doesn't actually happen that often. After all, I think it's just the kind of fear that we impose upon ourselves. Right. And the fact that that method has succeeded for so many years is, I think, part of what gives LDC its characteristic today, which is people are mostly independent. We get people right out of undergraduate degrees with only BAs, and we give them very large projects to manage, and they mostly succeed. And that's an interesting characteristic of LDC that I think is somewhat unique. And it dates back to us realizing that, you know, we can't rely on Mark for everything.
Mm-hmm. So we've also conducted a lot of experiments on our own. And you mentioned in your interview the satellite that we were using to collect as one of the things that we initiated. Mm-hmm. Can you provide some examples of this and explain the work and how it benefits the HLT community?
Sure. So you mentioned the satellite. That's probably the earliest example that I know of. So in By 1998, when I arrived in January, LGC had used like $120,000 of its own funds to purchase this gigantic satellite. And it was specially designed so that it allowed us to actually be on the distribution network for the Voice of America. So we were not getting VOA over the radio waves as you would normally get. We were actually on the distribution network. So if we had a transmitter, we could have been a VOA transmission site. We just did use it for collection. So we had very high quality VOA coming right from the source, the same way that the rebroadcasting site in any part of the world would receive the data. The cost of the satellite dish and also the cost of, VOA wasn't allowed to work with us unless there was some special permission provided. So we also had to work with Congress, with a congressman, to encourage him to have a public law passed, which provided VOA with the permission to work specifically with us just for this research project. Otherwise, they're prohibited from making their data available within the U.S., So the cost of all that negotiation and discussion and the cost of the satellite dish was something we bore on our own dime. And the beneficiaries were, the results were something like a couple thousand hours of VOA broadcast in like 53 languages or some large number of languages, that we couldn't have gotten otherwise. We would have been able to get one or two languages if we had to rely on the airwaves, right? Or had to put broadcasting stations all over the world, as VOA does, in order to be able to do that. So we couldn't have afforded it back then. So, and the beneficiaries were people in like the language ID community who have used that same data in a couple of different NIST evaluations that evaluate language ID technologies. So that's one example. Another example would be at the end of the topic detection and tracking program. So we had successfully expanded our annotation a little bit from transcription to now transcription. I think we were doing story segmentation. We were doing topic relevance judgments and maybe also novel information judgments. And that's about what we were doing. And we were also getting some things translated. But we wanted to expand beyond that. I wanted to sort of generalize it so that more or less any annotation could be done. So I called a guy named John Garofalo, who was at NIST at the time. He is still at NIST. He was in the speech group at NIST at the time, and asked him what he thought were the hot new annotations for the next couple of years. And John mentioned entity tagging. Exactly. So, you know, inside of text, find all mentions of persons, places, organizations, geopolitical entities, and so forth. So we started doing that. We, again, using our own dollar, trained some people to do entity tagging, and then actually had them annotate a corpus, part of which had already been annotated by someone else, so we could compare our accuracy and our speed against the existing corpus. And we're able to then send that data to John and help convince him that we could do entity tagging as well as anyone else could. And that led to a very large amount of similar information, work that supports information extraction. So we, as a result of that, did some work for the ACE program, for the Less Commonly Taught Languages program, where we tagged entities, relations, events. The entities included temporal and spatial events. We tagged coreference, even across documents. And there are maybe 100 corpora in our catalog that have something to do with that first initiative, that have something to do with tagging for information extraction. So the beneficiaries are those two programs, the Automatic Content Extraction, or ACE program, the LCTL, or Less Commonly Taught Languages program, and I don't know how many users there are of those 100 corpora, but a large number, I'd say. Mm-hmm. Those are old examples, two new examples. About 3 years ago, we hired a research assistant to start studying the impact of LDC data as measured through the number of papers that mention our corpora. So that work is only about 70% complete, but we found 9,000 papers that make some mention in one form or another of LDC corpora. So our goal of that work is to create a system that allows people who write papers to register the fact that this paper is about a given corpus. Those who contribute corpora to measure their impact on the field, which maybe encourages them to make more contributions. And also people who want to use a corpus in some research to prepare themselves by reading the other papers that use the same corpus and learning its shortcomings and its strengths. So that's a benefit of that work. And maybe one more, which is a year ago, we had two research assistants review about 100 different social networking sites to understand what kinds of activities the sites allow and what kinds of incentives the sites use to try to encourage people to keep coming back to the site. And the motivation for doing that was this recognition that some people will spend countless hours and contribute very large amounts of data to some cause just because they think it's a worthy cause without monetary compensation. And of course, some people won't contribute for only monetary compensation. They need some other kind of compensation. And if you only rely on monetary compensation, then you're only getting data from people who need monetary compensation or who want it. And so you're actually biasing your sample by doing that. So the idea with this study is that we would try to take advantage of this potentially limitless supply of energy that people are willing to invest and direct just a little bit of it toward our goals, which are to improve language technologies, and then hoping that improving those language technologies improves understanding and improves the quality of life on the planet. So that's, I think, a worthy goal. But to be able to accomplish it, we sort of have to understand what motivates people to spend countless numbers of hours on things like social networking sites. And that was the function of that work. But I should mention that I include in that category things like LibriVox, which isn't really what you think of as a social networking site. But if you look at how people on LibriVox interact, of course, the commonest interaction is that you download books that have been read by somebody and you listen to them. And so you have free books on tape. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of free man's free substitute for Audible, right? Mm-hmm. For old out of copyright material. But that's not the only interaction that happens. The other interaction that happens is that some people volunteer to be readers. And they volunteer because they love the book and they want it to be available in audio form. Or because they know somebody who is disabled, maybe is blind or vision impaired, and they want that person to have access to the book. Or because they believe in the thing in general. And they interact with each other also. So that is, there's a bulletin board on LibriVox where the authors work together. First of all, they work together to try to get the books read because they're frequently multi-person efforts. There's a editor and a proofreader, and there's an organizer and a coordinator, and there's five readers, or sometimes they play roles, sometimes they read chapters individually, sometimes they dramatize. But they also socialize with each other, and I think they get some benefit out of being part of this community that's doing good, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, there's even some other kinds of benefits for some of them. So some of those readers have gone on, I see, by looking at the bulletin boards, have gone on to build careers for themselves. So some of the best readers are now actually professional readers for other organizations because they were discovered on LibriVox, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, there's all these benefits. And in fact, all those same benefits you could imagine working for LDC, right? So what if you establish yourself as a speaker of a given language, and then by contributing some small amount of data, you demonstrate that you can speak this language natively, and you also demonstrate that you have an excellent voice, and maybe you demonstrate that you can translate from that language into some other language. Now you've suddenly, it's almost like what LinkedIn does for you, right? You've established some kinds of credentials showing that you can do work, maybe paid work, in those fields. So that even that you can see as a kind of incentive that we at LDC haven't thought about in the past, but that we're thinking about now. Mm-hmm. So instead of just giving somebody a dollar for an hour, for a minute of speech, or whatever, we maybe can offer some other benefits that will get the people who don't really care about the dollar, but care about something else. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple examples where we spend our own money on things which we think are going to have long-term benefit, either for the HLT community or for the broader community.
Mm-hmm. So we're down to the last mm-hmm. question and then closing thoughts. What are some research areas where you expect us to go into in the future?
Mm-hmm. So maybe first we should say that, again, if you're working at LDC or if you're interacting with LDC, one thing you have to be ready for is sort of constant evolution in the kind of research that we do. Now, some people look at this and think it's kind of maddeningly chaotic, right? We've actually even lost one staff member who said, I can't take the rate of change at this place. I'm going back to industry where things are calm, which is kind of funny, actually. I think the industry is calmer than academia. I just think it's honest, right? I just think what we're doing is being honest. So we know that research in HLT, and in fact, all research has needs that change pretty regularly. More or less after every experiment, you learn something, and that should affect the way your method grows. And that's also the case for LDC. So even if we are in the same government-funded program, working on the same language, and even doing a kind of annotation which has the same name, like we're doing entity annotation or relation annotation, from one effort to another effort, from 1 year to another year, or even sometimes within the year, that work changes. Even though it sounds like it's the same work, it changes. And that's just us responding to the fact that we've learned something on each cycle, you know, between creating data, delivering data, and having it used in some experiment. We learn that we learn something new, and that affects how we do data collection. So we just have to recognize that and build it into our process. And I think that means that what we do always changes, and there'll be never one moment when it's sort of changing more than another. It's just sort of a constant, there's never one moment when it's changing, one moment when it's static. It's always changing. And we just have to get used to that idea and not really expect too much stasis. But to give you some specific examples, I think that, as I said a few minutes ago, our collection will move increasingly in the direction of employing the incentive models and the interactional models that you see on things like social networking sites, at least the kind like LibriVox. I don't think that we'll ever completely get rid of the, you know, dollar a minute for speech or whatever method, but it's obviously limiting, and so eventually we have to get beyond that. And maybe one more reason to get beyond it is because, you know, even things like labor laws and tax laws affect just how widespread that practice can be, whereas other methods of interaction of the kind that you see on social networking sites would allow us to get data from people all around the world, would provide them with something they see that's of value too, without necessarily having to actually exchange a dollar and collect a social security number or whatever. Mm-hmm. A second place where I see us changing would be that I think our annotation is going to continue to be outsourced. So we're already doing experiments with outsourcing of two kinds. One, we have remote annotating facilities. We have a couple of them in different parts of the world. And we're also now doing annotation that's diffuse. So it's not just that there's another annotation group in Tunis, as there is, but it's also the case for some annotations, the annotators are all over the world already. We're already using Mechanical Turk, and we're already doing things that are Mechanical Turk-like without using Mechanical Turk, using our own infrastructure. I think that's going to increase, and I think really that's another goal for us, is to try to make our training and our evaluation of staff efficient enough that we can afford to bring people on for any language, for regardless of where they are, train them to do a kind of annotation task, and then evaluate whether they're doing it really quickly without having to have them physically here in Philadelphia. That's a challenge for us. Mm-hmm. And the last two, I think that we'll continue to integrate human language technologies into our data production pipeline so that as we're collecting data, we're exploiting technologies that have been built and improved by the fact that they have some data available to them, and just bringing those back into the pipeline to make the collection more efficient. We have to be careful when we do this not to bias the collection, but we have already shown that we can integrate HLT without bias in the collection. For example, when we use automatic speech recognition in broadcast news collection, we don't use it to create the transcript. That is, if the data has to be transcribed, we create the transcript by hand, and we don't allow the computer to bias us in creating the transcript. But we do allow the computer and the ASR systems to do things like point out to us where the confidence scores of existing systems are low, or where multiple systems disagree over how the passage should be transcribed, because those are cases where when they disagree, they're probably all wrong. And in those cases, that's material we really should transcribe and provide as training. On the other hand, if three or four speech recognition systems give roughly the same transcript for the same piece of audio, they're probably all correct, and probably the technology doesn't really need any more of that kind of data. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of how we integrate HLT without biasing the way we annotate data, although it does, of course, help us choose what to annotate. Mm-hmm. The last thing I think we would do is continue to integrate research and the knowledge that results from research into the work that we do, so that we are always, every time we do an annotation project for the second time, or even when we begin a new one, we're familiar with the latest research that involves that kind of annotation task and the technology that results from it, so that our methods and also the kinds of data that we produce are appropriate to that need. So I think those are the four areas where I see LDC going in the future.
Nice. Excellent. So, yeah, any closing thoughts?
Just that I'm looking forward to the next 20 years.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sitting down with us.
Absolutely. And, thanks, John, for organizing the whole thing.
Oh, no problem.